Hello everyone, welcome to Computer Science E7. This is Lecture 3, Exposure. Now, last week, we're actually getting just a little bit behind, I gotta say, because I go off into a lot of tangents, and even though I talk really quickly, it doesn't seem to be quite quickly enough. So just one thing I do want to mention that we will be having, we will be starting our sections schedule starting today. So Mondays from 5:30 to 7:30 in 53 Church Street, number 201. And the first section will be starting today from 7:35 to 9:35 in 51 Brattle Street, number 123/5. And again, that's not a typo. And probably in the latter half, I will introduce the TFs who will be leading these sections. And of course, it's not willy-nilly, you can follow the TF to the 51 Brattle Street section. And these are definitely very much recommended, especially with something in particular that I'm going to show you today that's going to look a little complicated and mathy, but don't worry, no need to be scared. We will go over it in as much detail as we can in lecture and again in sections, so you won't have to be too worried about it, hopefully. Yes?
So the sections will be recorded?
The sections will not be recorded. They are local and live only. Yes? Yes, it's the same material. So the Tuesday section and then the following Monday will both have material covered in the Tuesday lecture. So it goes Tuesday. The material presented in the Tuesday lecture will then be gone over in the Tuesday section and then the following Monday section, and then the cycle starts over. Any other questions? Okay. Now, last week, I started to go into a little bit of detail, or we started talking a little bit about exposure, and in particular, what can happen when you over or underexpose something. What, as a quick reminder, what do these two terms mean? So first, overexposure. What does this mean? What does it mean to overexpose a photograph? Too much light. And the end result is that it becomes too bright, and we lose a lot of detail in the final image. And this is particularly important when it comes to digital sensors, because digital sensors have a very specific cutoff beyond which the light will just appear to be completely white and you will get no more detail. Film was a little bit more resilient. You could have a little bit more leeway in the amount of overexposure in film, but with digital, there's definitely a very hard cutoff. You put too many photons into one pixel in a digital sensor, and that's it, game over. You will get no more detail. It will look completely white, and that's it, even though there might be some additional detail there. So that is the risk of overexposing an image. So what about underexposing? It follows from the overexposure that it's not enough light. It's definitely too dark. Now, there's not really a good example of underexposed image here. This image might look slightly underexposed, but that's mostly just because of the contrast in this particular projector. It looks fine on the computer screen, and this might actually be the same problem that we ran into last week where the gamma wasn't quite correct. Don't worry, we will fix shortly. Now, there's a variety of ways that we can actually control the amount of light that enters into a camera. We don't actually have to care about the precise number of photons that can be recorded by a digital camera. But we have to know that there is a range of photons that we can capture, lower than which will be too dark and higher than which will be too bright, that we will overexpose an image. So we have to then do a variety of things to try to set some settings in the camera to try to capture the correct number of photons. And it's important to realize that no matter what you do, no matter how you change the settings in a camera, you can never add more photons. You only have as much light as exists in real life. So however much light exists now, that's how much light we will have to work with. You will never get more. And that may sound obvious, but eventually when we start talking about these three particular settings that actually impact the exposure in the primary way, it might become a little bit confusing when we say, oh, you can let in more light this way and less light this way. You have to remember that you're not actually letting in more light than actually exists. But we will talk more about this, of course, as time goes on. So the first of these three settings is shutter speed. And we talked about how at the end of last week, how if you have a very long shutter speed, you're collecting more and more and more photons. Now typically a digital camera will have a very fast shutter speed. It will take a picture in a fraction of a second. And that's usually just that one click that you hear as the mirror goes up and the shutter opens and it takes the photo and the shutter closes, the mirror comes down, and that's it. but usually in a very dark room or in a room where there's just not a lot of light, or in the case where you have changed the other settings so that there is now less light coming into the camera, you might have to open up the shutter for a longer period of time so that photons can collect on the film or the sensor to be properly exposed. Now, yes, I did say that there's a finite number of photons in this room. It's only this bright. But it is possible to have that shutter open and just keep collecting photons, because it's not like there's just one flash of photons and then that's it. That, of course, comes when we talk about flash next week. But in this room, there's a constant amount of light that's continuously flowing through time. So the longer that we have this shutter open, the more light we can capture. So in the case of a pinhole photo, for example, where we have this very, very small hole in the front of the camera and it's not collecting a lot of light, we have to have the shutter open for a very long amount of time to keep collecting photons and keep collecting photons so that we can actually properly expose the photograph. Now, having the shutter open for a very long amount of time raises a couple of very important concerns. First of all, what do you think might happen if I'm holding the camera like this and I just have the shutter open? And I'm kind of moving it around a little bit and I get lazy and I do this. Yeah. Right, you get a very blurry result. And the reason for that is because it's continuously collecting photons. So if I'm collecting photons of, say, that window right there, so that eventually I'm trying to take a picture of that window, and that's the scene that I want, but I have a very long shutter speed, and halfway through the time that the shutter is open to when it's supposed to close, I move the camera. Now suddenly those same photons aren't reaching the sensor. It's not reaching the film, so it will change slightly. And the end effect will be that it appears as though there is some movement, that there's some blurriness to the photograph. And hopefully I will be able to demonstrate this. Let's see, I do have, cross my fingers, I did create an application a while ago that actually takes the camera on my computer and basically does this in sort of a live demo, but I may be doing a lot of talking for no particular reason at all, because as soon as I open, it crashes immediately. So let's see if I can do one more thing. All right, this might have to be something that I show you after, of course, the break when I'm able to fix it. But for now, just keep in mind that the longer you have the shutter open. So another way to think about this is that if you are collecting photons and you have just one light, let's say a laser or just like a little pen light or a flashlight or something like that, and you're pointing it at the camera, or at the sensor more specifically, and you start to move this around in, say, a circular fashion, what will happen as you are collecting all of the photons from that circular motion will be that the end result will look like you have a circle. And so you might have seen some of these photographs where a lot of people will take like a flashlight and write their name, or they'll write like hello or something like that. That is precisely how they're able to do this. They use a very long exposure time, and there's not very much light, so it's not really collecting a lot of light in the scene itself, but they have a flashlight. And with that flashlight, they write out their name, or they write out a word or something like that. And you'll see this particularly as people start to learn how to work with shutter speed. And usually you can mix the two together in sort of an interesting fashion. And so along these same lines, it's not just this specific technique that you can use, you know, with a flashlight to try to do so-called painting with light or to get some sort of neat shutter speed effects. You can do this especially with fireworks. A lot of people really, really like to take firework photos, but the problem with most of them is that their shutter speed is too fast. So what is captured by the camera as soon as it takes the photo of a firework is maybe just a little bit of the trails, right? You know what I mean? Where the explosion occurs and you take a photo and then you see just a little bit of the trails, and it's just not as exciting as it potentially could be. So the remedy for this would be to adjust some of the other settings so that you can hold your shutter open for a longer period of time. Doing this will result in these very long trails of light as the powder that has been exploded in the firework actually travels along the frame. So like this, for example, this is actually a firework photo that's not obvious because it's not of a firework itself, but rather the scene that's surrounding it. So there were some fireworks exploding off frame to the top. And what's interesting, I thought, was the light that was flashing onto the boats below, and also that all of these firework pieces were falling into the river. And you can see the trails as it falls from the sky, almost like a laser beam. It's being shot from aliens from the sky. You're able to get this kind of effect. Now, I mentioned just a little while ago, I asked the question, what would happen if I was holding the camera and pointing it, say, at this window, and I had a very long shutter speed? Well, and the answer was that it's probably going to be a little bit blurry. And no matter how hard you try, no matter how hard you try to keep the camera very, very still, I guarantee that for anything longer than, say, maybe an eighth of a second or half a second or so, you are going to get some blur into your images. And this is one of the most important reasons why having a tripod is one of the best additions you can get in your photographic kit. Because having a tripod means that the camera will be absolutely positively still as you keep the shutter open for a long period of time. Now, there are some sort of tricks to this, and that is that even when a camera is sitting on a tripod, it's still possible for the camera to shake, especially if you are doing the upgrade path where you buy, let's say, just a compact camera, and then you say, okay, well, I need a tripod next. So you get a tripod, and it's just sort of like one of those small aluminum tripods that you can get from like Best Buy or whatever. Then you decide, okay, well, now I've outgrown this camera, now I will get an SLR. So you get an SLR, and you still try to use this considerably heavier camera on still a very light tripod. Now, this is actually what I did many years ago, and what happened eventually was that the threads on the screw that tightened the little head to keep it in place actually got stripped, so no longer was I able to actually keep the camera in place. And what would happen is that as I took the photo, the camera would slowly start to tilt down until it finally fell over. And yes, it had some really interesting photos, but it was all streaks up and down as the camera fell over. It was just not a reasonable thing. So it's important to have a tripod that is strong enough for not only your camera, but also for the lens on it. Because you might have a lens that's considerably lighter than another one. And it's definitely important to keep in mind the weight of the total amount of equipment that you're putting on this tripod. Having one very light lens is not going to put as much strain on the tripod head as a much heavier lens. Yes? Does the subject also have to be perfectly still? Yes, if you don't want them to be blurry. So if we are talking about taking a picture of people, for example, then you still have this same sort of problem where they have to sit very still. And if you're trying to take photos of kids or pets, it's going to be pretty much impossible to try to get them to sit still long enough for you to manipulate the settings and have a shutter speed of sufficient length to actually take a photo, so on and so forth. But this is actually, I think, a different issue that I will address in just a second. So what I'm talking about now is keeping your tripod steady. So you can actually have this so-called motion blur. Motion blur is the blur that can happen when as something moves across the image. So like this little speck of firework, for example. That portion we would consider motion blurred because it has been blurred as it streaks across the screen. Whereas some of these other things, like the boats, for instance, they're not blurry, they're sharp. So we would not call this image as a whole to have motion blur. It really is context sensitive when we would use this particular term, motion blur. But sometimes it's good, sometimes you want it as we do in this case, and sometimes you do not want it, as in the case of when you're taking photos of people. Now there's a kind of a useful trick to try to remember to determine if you think you will be able to hand hold an image. So there is actually a limit that you will notice, and as you get better with skill, there's definitely a right way and a wrong way to hold a camera. Some ways will give you more stability with it. So if you're not familiar, you hold the camera, you know, that's obvious, with your right hand, and then you put your left hand underneath the lens, especially if it's a bigger lens. That's the correct way to hold it. Sometimes I see people holding SLR cameras like this, like it's a compact camera. That's not going to give you the most stability, particularly with larger lenses, because many lenses can actually be heavier than the cameras themselves, and you will just get this sort of downward force on your hands, and it will be very, very difficult to handhold this. But anyway, the trick to remember is to take a look at the number of how zoomed in you are on your particular lens. Let's say this lens goes from 24 millimeters all the way up to 70 millimeters. And we'll talk more about what this means, of course, at a later date. But let's say I'm all the way zoomed in at 70 millimeters. I would remember, okay, at 70 millimeters, I can safely handhold this lens with a shutter speed of about 1/70th of a second or faster. So you just take the focal length, do 1 divided by the focal length, and that's approximately what you can expect to get a sharp photo by hand holding it. And what I'm talking about with sharp photo is assuming that everything else is still in the photo, you're not going to notice a lot of motion blur. Now, of course, you could actually still get motion blur out of it despite this sort of trick, you know, especially if you're being, you know, really obnoxious to your camera and you're like, oh yeah, I'll show him and his 1/70th trick, and you're moving the camera all around, you will get motion blur with that. But if you're making an active attempt to try to reduce the motion blur, 1/1 the focal length is a good guide for you to start out with. You might have to get a little bit faster, especially if you have a compact camera. Now, one of the things, an SLR with a cropped sensor, because it has a smaller sensor, it actually is as though you have a slightly longer lens on it, and that's sort of a generalization, but of course, you know, talk more about it later, et cetera, et cetera. So, now, one of the things that I should mention is this concept of a shutter speed is in seconds. It's how many seconds your shutter is open. And usually you see it in terms of a fraction, like 1/8 of a second. This is not 1/8, but this is 10 seconds. Sometimes you'll see like 1/8 of a second. Sometimes you'll see something ridiculously fast, like 1/2000th of a second. And typically that's kind of a safe shutter speed. So it's important to realize that just because you have a big number like 2000 doesn't mean that it's slow. 1/2000 is a really, really small number, so that is going to be a very, very fast shutter speed. Does that differentiation make sense? We want a much smaller number for our shutter speed because that means the shutter will be open for a smaller amount of time, which means that we would say that the shutter speed is faster. So a faster shutter speed would be something like 1/8000th of a second, 1/4000th of a second, and a slower shutter speed would be something like 1/2 second or 1 second or 10 seconds in the case of this photo here. So it's important not to get confused by that fraction. When you see 1/ something, when you have a bigger number on the bottom, that's going to be a faster shutter speed. But when you don't have that fraction, a bigger number will be a slower shutter speed. So 10 seconds is faster than 30 seconds. But 10 seconds is slower than 1/30th of a second. Hopefully this differentiation makes sense, but it's definitely something very important. Okay, so fireworks. So what if we move on? What if we talk about something where rather than the camera having shake, so let's say that you get a good tripod, you mount your camera on the tripod and it's nice and still, it's not going to go anywhere. Now you can actually get motion blur in the subject of the photo. And this is what the question before was referring to, is that sometimes you want to get your subject to move a little bit. Now sometimes you don't, but sometimes you do, in the case especially of, say, moving water. Now, sometimes you might see some photos of landscape photography or what have you with, like, waterfalls or, you know, really nice, really smooth flowing water. They achieve this by having a really, really long shutter speed. The longest you can possibly get is going to be better in terms of getting sort of this milky, very smooth flowing of the water. If we had a much faster shutter speed, you would see the water as it appears, which is just, you'd capture it in the middle of it at the exact moment where it was in time, and it would look still. It would look as though there's no motion in the image. So by applying some motion blur, you can actually give the image some life, and you can give it some movement, even though it's obviously still. But we would call this image as having some movement within it, just because you sort of see that there is some movement within the image. So to accomplish something like this, again, you would have to have a good solid tripod so that you're not moving the camera around, and just take as long of a shutter speed as you possibly can. Now, one thing, if you are going to be using a tripod, you might notice that even if you have the most stable tripod in the world and you have placed the camera on top of it, there might still be times when you can actually get motion blur. And the reason for that, particularly with SLR cameras, is that the mirror that's inside of the SLR camera has some weight to it. It has some mass. So when the motor flips it up and out of the way, it hits the top of the camera, and there's some very slight vibrations. You won't see it and you won't feel it, but because the pixels in the camera are so unbelievably small, it's enough of a movement that you can actually get some very, very slight motion blur. And there's a couple of ways to fix that. And one of the easiest is just to set the timer on your camera. So if you have a timer of, say, 10 seconds, for example, you can try to eliminate one particular type of motion. So another problem that can happen is that your motion of actually hitting the shutter button, you actually pushing down on the shutter button, can be enough to cause the camera to wobble or shake ever so slightly. That also can contribute to this. So by having a timer set, you can eliminate that possibility. So for 10 seconds, for example, you can take the photo, you can let the camera be still, and it will stabilize in those 10 seconds. When it takes the long exposure photo, it will be relatively still. Now, to counteract the other problem that I just mentioned with the mirror actually hitting the top and causing a slight vibration that way, there's another feature on many SLRs called the mirror lockup. And it might be called something slightly different depending on your particular model, but it's usually a setting or a switch that you can flip in your camera. And what it does is that it causes a change in the way that the shutter button behaves. So typically, if I were to take a photo right now, I push down on the shutter button, we know that the mirror will flip up, and then the shutter will open, and then it will close to take the photograph. But in mirror lockup mode, what happens is that you have to push the shutter button twice to take a photo. The first time you push the button, it will move the mirror up and out of the way. Then you can wait a few seconds for the vibrations of the movement of the mirror to actually stabilize. Then when you push the button again, you will actually get the shutter then opens and closes. And so it's sort of an important distinction. So, for example, if I were taking just a photo right now, just a typical photo, let's see, oh no, I have mirror lockup on. Okay, so this is what happens with mirror lockup. I push the shutter button and the mirror moves up and out of the way, and it's still up and out of the way. And in fact, if you look inside of the camera, you can see the closed shutter. And as soon as I push this button again, the shutter opens and closes really quickly, and then the mirror comes back down. Now, when I turn off mirror lockup, it is disabled. Now what happens is what we expect. I push down the button, and it opens. It does all of those things all at once. It brings up the mirror, opens the shutter, closes the shutter, brings down the mirror. Versus with mirror lockup, where the first time it brings up the mirror and it locks it there, and then you can use the shutter once again. And this is especially good in combination with the timer. Because what happens on many cameras, when you have both the timer and mirror lockup set, is that when you push you only have to push the shutter button once, and the first time you push it, it brings up the mirror, and after a couple of seconds, it then completes the photograph. So it does it for you automatically, which is better, perhaps, because then your motion of actually touching the shutter button won't actually cause this additional vibration. So using both mirror lockup and and the timer can effectively eliminate a lot of the motion in your camera. So you can get rid of a whole bunch of motion blur. And with many SLR cameras, there's sort of a sweet spot when these problems will become especially pronounced. And that's between about, I think, 1/15th and 1/60th of a second. That's just slow enough of a shutter speed that the motion of the mirror will cause it to vibrate and you will notice it. Any faster of a shutter speed than that, you're not really going to have this problem. Any slower of a shutter speed, the vibration will end up clearing out by the time the shutter has closed anyway. So it's really in that sort of important 1/15th to 1/60th of a second you have to worry about it. But I would argue that for very important photos where you have the time to be able to turn on the mirror lockup and do it this way, this is the better route. Now, obviously, we don't always want to have motion blur in the photo. And in fact, many times we want to stop the motion of some fast-moving objects. And so the way to do this is to obviously use a faster shutter speed, to have some shutter speed that is some thousandths of a second. And in this case, this is 1,250th of a second, and it was almost enough to stop the motion. If you actually look at the original photo, you can actually see that there's a little bit of motion blur in the soccer ball, but for all intents and purposes, we have stopped the motion in this particular case. And this is good when you want to freeze action. You'll have a fast shutter speed. And by default, many times, many cameras try to do this for you. The reason for that is that if you're not freezing action, you're also not freezing the movement of yourself as you move the camera around, especially as you just try to hand hold it. So having a very fast shutter speed is good at not only freezing the action of the subjects, but also your own action as you try to hold the camera in your hand. So this is something that is very useful. And if you might remember that rafting photo, where that was definitely using very fast shutter speed, because as opposed to having this sort of milky white smooth water, it stopped the motion of the water, and you could see individual droplets in the air, and that was because it had a sufficiently fast shutter speed. Now, sometimes you want to have a combination of these two things. Sometimes you might want to have some movement and have some still action at the same time. So this image before, this is one example when you might want to do that. But this, frankly, is a little bit lucky, just because the boats weren't moving quickly enough for a 10-second exposure to really show any sort of visible motion blur in them. But it was also lucky enough to be able to get the motion of the firework. So I would say this is sort of a lucky thing. But many times, you actually want to intentionally do this. So for example, anytime you do any sort of photography with cars or with planes or any sort of transportation, sometimes you want to show that this object is moving. Especially if it's moving relatively quickly, you want to give it the perception that the wheels are turning, that the pavement is moving by at sort of a fast pace, but you don't want to, at the same time, you don't want to motion blur or blur out the details of the object itself. So how are we able to combine these two things? What do you think I did to take a photo like this? Just in terms of shutter speed, yes. Right, exactly. So have maybe a little bit slower of a shutter speed. So in this case, this car, I'll tell you, was moving very, very quickly. And at 1/300th of a second that this photo was taken, it did move quite a bit. But if you follow the object as you were taking a photo, and if you have the shutter open for just enough time for you to capture that movement, if you do it right, you will get very sharp, non-motion blurred image in the object that you're tracking. And the background or the foreground or what have you that is actually not moving will become relatively motion. You will see the motion as a result. So usually you can experiment with this. You can try to set a shutter speed that's in between very slow. What I would consider very slow is like 1/8 of a second, you know, 1/2 a second. That's pretty slow of a shutter speed. And that's definitely too slow to capture something like this. And something that would be much faster, like 1/1000th of a second or 1/2000th of a second, a shutter that is opening and closing that quickly would actually freeze the motion. So you might try something in between that, and it really depends on the speed of the object that you're trying to capture and the speed of the movement of your camera as you pan it across. And when you're trying to take a photo like this, it's really useful to do several or many practice runs where you're just following the object that you're trying to take a photo of and just hold down the shutter button and set your camera to repeatedly take photos. And as you track it, hopefully one of those will actually turn out to be kind of okay. Now, of course, there's other problems too, like focusing and all that stuff, but this is something that takes some practice, and you'll have to attempt a couple of ways to get right. So what is essentially happening, because you're panning the camera at the relative same speed that this was moving, was that these portions of the car, to the camera's perspective, were still. There was no motion in it because I was panning it at the same speed as the car was moving. So that's why this looks sharp. Whereas the background and the foreground, you can actually see some visible motion because those objects were moving relative to the sensor's position, if that makes sense. Okay, so there's some other ways that you might want to be able to do this. For example, if you can take pictures in cars, so you might want to have one for some self-portraits where you can have like some stuff outside is sort of has a lot of movement, and inside the car there's not a lot of movement. And again, just to give you a couple more examples, to stop some motion, you would have very, very fast shutter speed like this. This is 1/1000th of a second, and you can actually see individual water droplets as they fall off of the raft. So just to give you an idea, again, let's say this photo was taken at 1/1000th of a second. So one of the things that we haven't talked about but is really important is what is one-stop difference. So if I wanted to make this photo one-stop brighter, let's say I took a photo and it came out like this, but it was too dark. It was maybe one-stop too dark. How would I adjust the shutter speed to get one stop of additional brightness?
Well,
So recall what a stop is. What is a stop, if we go back just a little bit? A stop of light is?
Double.
I'm sorry?
Doubling
or halving the amount of photons, right? So doubling or halving the intensity of the light. So if I have a photo like this, and it was taken at 1/1000th of a second, and it's too dark, and I want one stop brighter, what does that mean? What is the shutter speed now? It has to be twice as slow, right? So it's going to be 1/500th of a second. If it's too dark, it has to be with the number on the bottom has to be a lower number for you to have a slower shutter speed. So 1/500th of a second means that the shutter will be open for twice as long and you will collect twice as much light on the sensor. Now if I go the other way, let's say that I took this photo, it's 1/1000th of a second and it's too bright. Now what do I do to the shutter speed? Right, so I have to make it 1/2000th of a second. It has to be 1/2000th of a second, and that means that the shutter speed is twice as fast, so it will open and close in half the time that this 1/1000th of an open, and it will therefore be darker. So what about something like 1/60th of a second? What's one stop brighter? One stop brighter would be 1/30th of a second, because it's going to be open for twice as long. And then darker, one stop darker for 1/60th of a second would be 1/120th. And typically when we're talking about shutter speeds, you would see this on a camera. You will be able to change the shutter speed in divisions of stops. And many newer cameras can actually do thirds of a stop. But if you can turn that off usually, and you can actually take it from 1/1000th to 1/500th to 1/250th to 1/125th to 1/60th to 1/30th, so on and so forth. And each of those is collecting twice as much light as the previous. Now, if you're talking about shutter speeds in terms of seconds, where you don't have fractions like 1 second, it becomes a lot easier. So let's say we wanted to go one stop brighter for a 1 second exposure, we would have 2 seconds. And one stop darker would be? Half a second, yeah, that's right. All right, any questions on shutter speed? Everybody feel comfortable, because we do have to move on to some of the other very interesting and fascinating topics. Now, I've talked about how we might want to manipulate some of the shutter speed. So let's say that we want to perhaps collect a little bit more motion in an image. So maybe I look at this image and I say, okay, that's kind of cool, but maybe I want to see now some of the movement in the water. So if this photo was taken at 1/1000th of a second, and I want to start to see some movement in the water, how should I manipulate the shutter speed to start to see some of this motion blur in the water? Right, so I can try going down a stop. And so by going down, we actually mean that we need to make the shutter open for longer, which means that we would try 1/500th of a second. We might try that and see how much better that is. Yes?
Mm-hmm. You know, so not just doubling it or halving it. Do you still kind of go, should that be the progression to double it or kind of half it to give you a better idea than fine tune it from there?
It's easier for our discussion to talk about whole stops, to talk about doubling and halving. Having the finer grain control is usually a good thing. Usually you have thirds of a stop control over the shutter speed and some of these other values that we'll be talking about. But usually doing one full stop gives you a good enough difference that you can tell, okay, maybe this was too much. And then maybe you can go to finer grain control and try 1/3 or 2/3 of a stop difference. But usually starting, unless you know offhand through experience or just through whatever means that you only want a partial stop, usually starting a change in your photo by one stop increments is enough so that you would actually be able to see an actual change in it. You will be able to see a change in these smaller increments as well, but it's just not as pronounced. So using these stops is useful not only from our point of view, but also from yours as you're starting to learn what each of these things does and what it means in terms of of how this affects an image. Good question though. Okay. So I was saying, if we want to collect a little bit more motion in this image, we would then try a slower shutter speed. So we would try maybe 1/500ths of a second, maybe 1/250ths of a second, two stops down, to try to determine or to try to get a little bit more motion in this particular image. But at the same time, in the same breath, I just talked about how altering the shutter speed will have another impact on this image. What was that impact? The light, how bright this is. If we take an image with these specifications and it's well exposed, it looks like this, it's pretty well exposed, there's not really areas that we care about that are overexposed, we have good detail everywhere. We don't want to alter the exposure settings so that we suddenly overexpose this image. Now, luckily, this is why, or it's not why, but this is when we would use one of the other settings. We would try to manipulate some other setting to try to make it so that we can change the shutter speed without changing the end exposure, if that makes sense. Because ultimately, the sensor can only capture so much light. You don't want to make it too bright. You don't want to make it too dark. And by manipulating multiple of these variables at once, you can get a proper exposure with the right sort of style that you want in a particular image. And one of these other settings is ISO. Or if we were to, we could refer to it loosely as sensitivity, but it's that's sort of a misnomer. It's not exactly what it is. ISO, even though I say that, we can think of it as sensitivity. It's probably easier to think of it that way. So if we have a sensor that is particularly sensitive, that means that we can collect less light for a given shutter speed, right? So if we have a sensor that's very super sensitive and it requires fewer photons for us to be able to see detail, then what this means is that we can have a faster shutter speed for the same image, if that makes sense. Because faster shutter speed will result in fewer photons coming to the back of the sensor. But if we have a higher sensitivity sensor, this means that we don't have to collect as many photons to begin with. So sensitivity is measured in ISO, and ISO starts at about 100, and it's very, very nice. Just like with shutter speed, we double it or we have it to try to figure out how sensitive a particular camera will be. So for example, we might start at ISO 100, and to make it twice as sensitive, we would bump it up to ISO 200. We would double it to become twice as sensitive. To become twice as sensitive from there, we would bump it up again to 400, then to 800, then to 1600. Then now you're starting to get into territory where very few cameras can do it well, 3200, 6400, so on and so forth. And some of these cameras can get to ridiculously high ISOs. Some of them, not quite as much. The reason is that as we turn up this sensitivity on a number of cameras, and even on film, whenever you bought film with a particular ISO, the higher the ISO that you get, the grainier it's going to be. And the same thing happens in digital. So with an ISO of 1600, look at the gray box at the very top. See how much noise there is, how it's just sort of, it's not very gray. There's lots of speckles of color and just weird little pixels within it. And compare that to the less sensitive but much cleaner ISO 100. So here we can see that it's much, much cleaner, and it's not as bad. It's nowhere near as bad as the higher sensitivity option. So with everything in photography, you have it's a compromise. You cannot get anything for free in photography. So if we increase the sensitivity, because maybe you want to do this to get a faster shutter speed, and recall that this is possible because if we have something that is very, very sensitive, we don't have to have the shutter open for as long. It can open and close. And that amount of light is enough for a very sensitive sensor to be able to capture that image. Whereas if we had a less sensitive sensor, like something that's operating at ISO 100, it has to be open for a longer amount of time for those photons to be able to be captured by the sensor. So this goes back again to, if we were to go back to the film days, where a lot of times people would ask you, if you went and you tried to buy film, one of the things they might ask you is, do you want fast film or slow film? And this was the question that was asked you, and this directly relates to what I'm talking about. If you wanted fast film, this means that you are going to get film that was at a higher ISO. It was more sensitive, which means that you could use a faster shutter speed, hence the fast film. When the sensitivity is higher, you can use a faster shutter speed, and so that is why they called it this. Whereas if you use a much lower ISO, it is not as sensitive, and it takes longer to capture these photons. It takes longer for these photons to actually create an image in the end. So hopefully this distinction makes sense. But when we're talking in the digital world, noise comes up in a very interesting way. The smaller, for a variety of reasons, the older the camera or the smaller the camera, you're going to get more noise. And again, I'm generalizing. There's a whole lot of variables that we'll talk about more later, so on and so forth. But for compact cameras in particular, a compact camera that has a much smaller sensor that's compared to an SLR camera that's about the same technological generation, so if they were released at about the same time, the one with the smaller sensor will tend to have more noise. So compact cameras, for example, you'll notice that here ISO 100 looks pretty clean on this compact camera, whereas ISO 1600 now all of a sudden looks really messy, looks really dirty in this image, and it's worse if you were to actually view it on a computer screen. The projector's not very good, but you can still see how some of the detail is lost, to like some smudginess, and it's just not that great. Whereas if we compare it now to digital SLRs, not only is ISO 1600 much cleaner, but so is ISO 100. Compare the two, so I'll go back and forth. So if you pay attention in particular to the gray slot at the very top on ISO 100 on the left, if I go back, you'll notice that, yeah, it looked clean before, but it doesn't look as clean as the camera with a much bigger sensor. Now if we compare ISO 1600, you can see that, yeah, there's a bit of noise in digital SLR, but you still are retaining detail. It's really not quite that bad, whereas with compact cameras, it becomes a nightmare and it becomes quite a mess. Now, again, this isn't to trivialize compact cameras. Many modern compact cameras are starting to get it right, and they're using fewer pixels, which is a good thing, and they're trying to increase the light gathering capabilities of a sensor. Again, there's a whole bunch of variables that we'll talk about at a later date, but in general, you can expect compact cameras to have worse performance in terms of ISO as their much bigger brothers, as their much bigger cousins. Now, typically, this is something that usually, especially in the film days, you really wouldn't think of getting faster film, or you wouldn't think of going more sensitive than about ISO 1600. But with the way that technology has been progressing in digital cameras, you can see now ridiculously high ISO. So, for example, just to compare a camera that's not even that recent, this was a slide that I made a couple of years ago even, that compares the noise that you would see from a photo taken with film at ISO 1600, and look how noisy this is, and compare it to the noise of something that is many, many, many stops more sensitive, you'll notice that the Nikon D3 on the right actually has about the same amount of noise as the film days from ISO 1600. So how many stops brighter, or how many stops more sensitive is this ISO? ISO 25,600. How many stops? It's four stops. And the reason for that is that, so ISO 1600, if we double it to 3200, that's one stop more sensitivity. Double that again to 6400, that's two stops of sensitivity, 12,800, and then finally 25,600. So four stops more, and that may not sound like very much, but let's say that we had taken this photo at 1/100th of a second. If we can get four stops faster in shutter speed with this camera, how fast is that? So we go from 1/100th to 1/200th of a second, that's one stop, 1/400th of a second, that's two stops, 1/800th, that's now three stops, and finally 1/1600th of a second. So now we're at 1/1600th of a second in this camera, whereas before we could only take 1/100th of a second. So one stop makes actually a big difference. It doesn't sound like it, but because we're doubling and we're halving, it makes a much bigger difference than it actually might sound initially. Now, this isn't also to trivialize film, because one of the really nice things about noise in film is that it's very random. It's very soothing. It's very organic. It's very fine. It's not very grainy. But in digital, you can notice patterns many times in the way that the noise is presented to you in a digital photograph. And this can be jarring to some people, especially with some of the older cameras, especially some of the older SLRs. You would actually see patterns. You would see vertical or horizontal patterns in the noise, and it was it's nice that it doesn't have as much noise, but the fact that there's a pattern makes the noise that much more visible, if that makes sense. It just becomes more noticeable when you can notice the patterns in the noise compared to when the noise was just much more random. So some people still prefer the noise characteristics of the film cameras, and that's certainly fine, and that's certainly valid. And other people really like how low noise in the same ISO a lot of the modern digital cameras are. And this is something that that people decide when purchasing a camera, is the noise character. It's not the only thing, but it's one of the things that they look at, is how does the noise appear in the photograph? Because many times you might actually have to modify the ISO to try to alter the appearance of your photograph. So let's combine this with shutter speed in a more real way. So this was a photo that was taken at Lake Winnipesaukee in New Hampshire, and it was, in Veterans Day some years ago, looks like 2007. And if you go to Lake Winnipesaukee in November, there's basically nobody there. And it's really nice because you have pretty much the whole lake to yourself. And so I decided to take a photo that looks like this. And so you'll notice some interesting things about this. So here we've combined motion blur with still, like non-motion within the image, to get something like this, like the far end, there's no motion blur in it, and there's some movement in the water, but because of how long the shutter speed was, it just sort of smoothed out how this appears. So the water looks very, very still and very, very smooth, and you can actually start to see the trails of the stars as the Earth rotates. Now look at something that's particularly interesting. Notice that the stars that are on the left side of the frame seem to be longer streaks than the stars on the left side. Why do you think that might be? Why do we have longer streaks on the left side? What's that? Lights have to come down for the camera. Yeah.
They're further from the North Star. They're on a longer perimeter.
Right, that's exactly right. So because the Earth rotates and about an axis, if you're pointed kind of north, you'll actually see where the North Star is approximately the center of that rotation, and the other stars, they just seem to rotate around it. So the North Star is kind of up here in the upper left hand. It's not actually in the frame, but it's up there, and we're looking progressively further south, further away from the North Star in the left. And this big bright one in the middle, I actually asked an astronomer professor at MIT what he thought this one might be, and he told me it might be Vega, which is a big star somewhere. I remembered more details at the time, but it's Vega, so I thought that was cool. Anyway, so we have then these star trails, and in order to get something like this, you have to have a tremendously long shutter speed to try to capture the movement, because what we're doing is we're capturing the movement of the Earth itself. So you have to have a very long shutter speed, and in fact, that's reflected here at a shutter speed of 846 seconds. It's a long time, and it was cold. And luckily, though, I had that remote, so I didn't have to sit outside in the cold. I turned on the remote, and I went inside, had some coffee, and sat in front of the fire, and I just had a little timer, and then So yes, it was lazy, but it was also kind of fantastic. So anyway, how does ISO come into play here? Well, when I first took this photo, I wanted to use a shorter shutter speed because I didn't want to sit outside for 800 seconds, for almost, 15 minutes or so? I didn't want to sit out there for about 15 minutes and wait for it to take the photo. So I tried an ISO relatively high, about ISO 800. And I got a shutter speed of 336 seconds. And so you can then see the difference between the two. The crop on the right is this photo Vega in that original photo that you saw, the 846 second exposure at ISO 400. But when I had a higher sensitivity, in order to keep the photo at the same exposure, if I have a higher sensitivity, this means that I have to also correspondingly change the shutter speed. So if I have twice as much sensitivity in this photo, then I have to have half the shutter speed. So the shutter has to be open for twice as long. So going from 336 seconds at ISO 800 to, it's not exactly off. I also made it a little bit brighter. Going up to 846 seconds at ISO 400, you can see the difference in the length of the star trail. And you can also see the difference in the noise. Look at the noise in this photo as compared to this. There's less photo in the noise that has the lower ISO than there is in the photo that has the higher ISO. And because we've modified the shutter speed, you can see that the photo that has a faster shutter speed, so the photo that has the shutter that would open and close more quickly than the other, you can see that the star trail is not as significant. It's about half as much as the other one. And so you can see this in a very real way, because now you can actually see the length of the trail as it compares between the two. So this is the shutter speed in and the ISO in a very, very real way. So the left image was about 6 minutes. The right image was about 14 minutes. Again, I know it's not quite as much, and that's because, or it's not quite a doubling. That's because not only did I modify the ISO, but I also realized that this image was just a little bit too dark, so I wanted to collect more light at the same time. So I decided that maybe I want about a third of a stop more light, so I had to multiply by two and then add a little bit more in addition to that. So how then is it possible to take a photo like this? Remember that your camera has a bulb mode, which means that as long as you are pushing and holding down the shutter button on the camera, it will hold the mirror up and the shutter open as you take it. And some cameras actually have it on the dial up top. Some cameras you might have to read your manual to try to figure out how to do it. And some cameras, frankly, don't have it. But if you have an SLR, it can almost certainly do bulb mode. And it's particularly useful when you combine it with a remote that can hold down the shutter button for you, because it's a huge pain, I'm going to tell you right now, to stand outside for 15 minutes holding down the shutter as you try to take a photo in this way. So keep that in mind if you want to take some star trails. And usually I did kind of cheat a little bit. If I wanted true star trails, usually people will have their shutter open for literally hours and hours to get a good amount of motion in the Earth. But I had some things working against me at the time. That was that even though there's not very many lights here, if I had exposed for a longer amount of time, we would have gotten an effect called blooming, where those lights just sort of inundate and the brightness just grows bigger. That would be a big problem, especially at the horizon, where you can see that there's sort of a glow from a distant city. That would have become even more pronounced and just ruined the effect anyway. So to get star trails, not only do you have to have a very long shutter speed and keep your camera nice and warm so the battery doesn't die, and keep yourself nice and warm so you don't die, you also have to be able to make sure that you have an environment that is dark enough for you to take a photo like this. So there's a lot working against you with star trail, but it's also very rewarding. I think it can be a very fun way of doing this. Now, sometimes when you look at reviews of cameras, they will have, they will give you sensitivity measurements. Like they'll make this very quantitative. They'll show you, oh, look at how much better this camera is versus another one. And I would say this is a fine measurement. It's okay to look at it, but don't use it as your only decision when trying to make a decision about noise in a camera. You also have to look to see how the noise itself looks, because there's different types of noise that can exist within an image. You'll notice that there's three lines here. All of these lines reflect the noise of varying types for one camera as you increase the ISO. So this is for an older Canon camera called an A720IS. And as you increase the ISO, so it starts at ISO 80 and it goes up to ISO 1600 over here, they try to show you how much noise is present in the image. Now you'll notice that the top, so this red line right here, is called a chroma noise. And what chroma noise is the amount of additional color that is introduced into a photo because of noise. So you'll notice that maybe you can see it. You notice how in the top right, it's not actually very gray. There's kind of areas of green and areas of red. That's chroma noise, because it's introducing noise, chromatic noise or color noise, where previously there was none. Now there's other types of noise as well, and that is like luminance noise. So luminance gray, so that's the amount of brightness, so how much variance you would get in the brightness of gray or black pixels. So you can then see how those pixels would vary in brightness, where it's supposed to be a certain level of gray and maybe it's far too bright or far too dark. That's also a different type of noise, and you can see how that is affected here. Now, again, these measurements aren't everything. It's very important to take a look to see what this noise actually looks like in your images if you're trying to make a decision about a particular camera. Okay. When we come back in 5 minutes, we will talk about the third and final type of exposure value, aperture, and get out your math brains because we have just a little tiniest bit of math to talk about after this 5 minute break. Hey everyone, welcome back. So just quickly to reiterate the two sections. So sections start after class today, and John Selig, who's in the back, will be leading tonight's section, and you can follow him after class if you wish to attend. Certainly either or both of these are recommended for your helping you out with your knowledge in this material. It will be immediately after class at 7:30 in 51 Brattle Street, number 123/5, and again, that's not a typo, that's actually what the room is called. And on Monday, we will have a section from 5:30 to 7:30 in 53 Church Street, number 201, led by Kane, standing over here, sitting over there, and he will be leading that. And again, the material will go as follows. So we present lecture material on Tuesday, then that same material will be covered on the section immediately following, and then the Monday after that will be the same one. Then the cycle repeats from there. And we will soon post this section schedule on the course website under the sections heading. So, unless there are any other questions, we will continue. So, before the break, we were talking about the various exposure settings that you might manipulate to get a proper exposure in your camera. So, namely, shutter speed and ISO. But there's one more that's very important and, unfortunately, a little bit more complicated than the other two. It doesn't mean that it's difficult, it's just a little bit more complicated, and that's it. So, this is aperture, and that is, it's very much like the pupil in your eye. It's the pupil lets in light in your eye, and as you might know, the iris might close or open depending on the light situation, and it's the exact same thing that can occur in a camera. So there is an actual physical mechanism called an aperture, and that aperture might close or open depending on the specific needs of the particular photo. Now, usually when you take a look at a lens, and if you just sort of hold it up and look at it, the aperture is all the way open. It is what we call wide open, which means that there's a couple of blades that close down on aperture. So the opposite that is the default of many lenses is wide open. All of the blades are as completely far open as they possibly can be. Now, if you increase the F number, now there is a number that's associated with the aperture, and that is called the F number. And if you increase this F number, you will actually get less light that is entering into the camera. So it's as though as you increase the F number, the aperture is closing. So you're letting in less and less and less light into the camera. Now, this is very, very important because if you let in all of the light that's possible, it might be too bright for the scene. So you might have to then decrease, or you might have to increase your shutter speed if you're using a very wide open aperture, or you might have to decrease the sensitivity of your camera. That might be a good thing, but it does have an impact on the photos. Just like how as you increase the sensitivity, you get a bigger, you get more noise into the image, or as you make the shutter speed slower. So as you increase the amount of time that the shutter is open, you might get more motion blur into the image. The aperture definitely has a big impact into the camera as well. So let's see. Every year I try to do this demo, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So I will try this. So let's say I have this lens connected to my camera, and by default the lens that you see is wide open, and the reason that it is wide open is because it is letting as much light into the camera as possible, one, for you to be able to see properly when you're looking through the viewfinder, and also for it to be able to do the metering more accurately. The more light and also focusing. The more light that you have entering into the camera, the better chance you have for it to focus properly, the better chance you have for you to be able to see and compose the image properly. So it just makes sense that by default you will have the image be wide open. But if I increase the F number on the camera itself and I push a button that's right here, there's a little bit of a, or there should be, oh gosh. See, and it's not working now. So I must have changed what the setting does. So on this camera, typically there's a button that lets you have a preview of what happens. And if you actually push the button on your camera, you will, it's called a depth of field preview or something similar. What will happen is that you will notice that the aperture blades inside of your lens actually close, and it becomes a much narrower hole that that light can enter into. And when you look through the camera, you will notice that the viewfinder becomes significantly darker. The reason for that is just letting less light in. Now, the problem with F number is that it is not easily multiplied by 2. So shutter speed and ISO, that was very nice to us because we were very easily able to double or halve it to try to figure out what a difference in one stop might be. Now, aperture and its related term F number is not quite so easy. So typically you would see F numbers that start at F1.0, for example, and then it goes up to 1.4, to 2, 2.8, 4, 5.6, 8, 11, 16, 23. It just keeps going on and on and on in this fashion, and it doesn't sound like we're doubling it. And the reason for that is when we're letting in a certain amount of light, we have to realize that there is something kind of important going on geometrically, and that is that when I am letting in more light, let's say that I have the aperture open as much as possible, I'm letting in a certain amount of light. Now, if I want to make it one stop darker, what do I have to do? I have to make the aperture smaller, but by how much? So this is sort of a rhetorical question, it's a leading question, and that is that if I want to make it half as bright, I have to let in half as many photons. Right? So we've established this for a long time, for shutter speed especially. If we want to let in half as much light, we have to have the shutter open and close twice as fast. Now, because we're talking about something that's actually an area, it's a circle, when we're closing this circle, the area of the circle has to go down by 1/2. So hopefully that kind of makes sense, right? Because if we have a circle that's this big, it's letting in a certain amount of light. To let in half as much light, we have to have a circle that's half as big. And that is, strictly speaking, based on the area of the circle. The problem comes when we are talking about this term F number. F number isn't in terms of the actual area, but rather it's a ratio that involves the diameter of that circle. The diameter of the circle is involved in the actual F number rather than the area itself. So as you can imagine, there's probably some square roots and there's probably some squares that are going on that's causing this disruption in the F number so that it is not an easy double or halving. Now the F number itself is pretty easy of an equation to remember. It's the focal length of the lens divided by its diameter. That gives you an F number. So you can figure out the F number of a whole variety of things, not only like in the problem set, you're going to figure out the F number of the eye, the range of the F stops of the eye as the pupil opens and closes, which is actually kind of an interesting thing. But we also know the focal length of that, and we can figure out the diameter just by measuring. Now when we're talking about lenses, this can be just a little bit more confusing. So, I don't want you to worry about this, though, too much. There is actually a handout that I've written and posted on the course website. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get it printed for this week, but it is available as a PDF on the class website. We'll go over it in section, and hopefully, if I remember, I will also bring a copy for all of you next week. But it essentially describes the relationship, and we'll go over it now just so that you sort of see it firsthand, but you can also take this handout and break it apart and try to figure out exactly what's going on a little bit better this way. So if I have two circles, and again, so what's important to remember about this is the equation, this equation here, this simple division. The F number is the focal length divided by the diameter. That's really the only thing that that's really important to remember. But so that you understand where these numbers are coming from, I will also do some of this for you. So let's see, I will move the screen up just a little bit. Hopefully I don't have to make it go all the way up. Keep going. Ah, perfect. Oh, darn it. Okay, I will just make it go all the way up. Okay, now, isn't this exciting? It's like there's a big thing I'm about to show you. Okay, so what I'm telling you is that we have these F numbers. It starts at 1.0, then we have F1.4, then F2, then F2.8, then F4.0, then F5.6, and then F8, then F11, F16, so on and so forth. We can keep going in the same manner. Now, most of the time when you're looking at the aperture or at the F number, you will see numbers that look like this. And when you are actually modifying this setting on your camera, you will see this, you will see something that looks exactly like this. It will go from, it might start, it depends on the lens that you have on it, but it might start at like 2.0 and it'll go up to 2.8 to 4.0, etc. All of these are differentiable by one stop. So as we go from F1.4 to F2.0, we have a one-stop difference. Now, counterintuitively, as you get a higher F number, you are having a smaller diameter, which means that you're going to have less light enter into the lens. So a higher number means less light, whereas a lower number means more light. So typically, if you have a lens that starts at aperture F1 or an F number of F1.4, and you compare it to a lens that has an aperture of F, or rather an F number of F2.8, you can say, okay, this lens that has 1.4 is two stops faster or two stops brighter than that of the 2.8 lens. Because it is along in this scale, it is one stop to 2.0 to two stops to 1.4. And the lower numbers mean brighter. Okay, so when we are talking about when we're talking about it in this way, this hopefully will make a little bit of sense when we are talking about exposure values. So now, just to do a little bit of this math, let's say I have, and to show you where these numbers come from, let's say I have two circles. Now, I've told you that in order for us to be able to determine how, what one-stop difference is, we have to let in half as much light in one circle versus the other. So that means that this area given by this circle, A2, is half the area of A1. Everybody agree with that? So A2, we have an area A2 that is one half the area of A1. Now the problem is that when we're talking about the F number, that actual F number equation, F number equals what? What was that division? Focal length F divided by the diameter. So this is why it's unfortunate. We're not talking about area, but instead we're talking about the diameter, right? So when we go back to our high school geometry and we try to remember how the area is related to the diameter, we might remember the equation for an area of a circle, and that is that the area of a circle is pi times the radius squared, right? So this is how we might be able to relate these two together. And this squared right here is what is giving us this problem. And to show this to you, let's go a little bit further. So rather than talk about the radius, let's talk about the diameter. So recall that the diameter is twice the radius. The radius just goes from the center of the circle to the edge, and the diameter is just the entire line that extends from one end to the other. So we would then say that the radius is equal to the diameter divided by 2. Right? Okay. Hopefully everybody's following along. So I will place that into my equation now and say that I have this as my equation for the area. And the reason that I am doing this is that I want to compare the area. I want to compare the diameter of the circle that has the much larger area, the area that's twice as much, to the circle that has the much smaller area. If I can figure out, okay, well maybe, now maybe if this diameter is so much smaller than this other one, we might be able to shine a little bit of light onto how these numbers are formed. Okay, so I have this. I'm saying that the area of the circle is pi times the diameter divided by 2 squared. Okay, and I have one more equation though. I am saying this as well, that the area of circle 2 is half the area of circle 1. Any questions on this so far? Hopefully I haven't lost anybody quite yet. So I can say this another way also. I will say this, I will say that. The area of the first circle is twice the area of the second circle. I'm just saying this a different way. And so now I will plug this in to try to figure out what the diameter is. So I'm saying that the area for the first one is pi times the diameter of the first circle divided by 2 squared. That equals 2 times pi times the diameter of the second one divided by 2 squared. Right? So now all I've done is I've taken these two equations and I've merged them together to try to figure out how we can compare the diameter of this larger circle to this smaller circle. So now we can cancel out the pi because we've divided both together. Now, any ideas how we can proceed from here? And so there's a whole bunch of math that's on the handout itself, but the end result is that, let's see, we can get rid of these divided by 2s because it's essentially divided by 4. So we have, in the end, the diameter 1 squared is equal to 2 times the diameter 2 squared. Okay, so we've just canceled out some of these things. Now, if I want to figure out what the diameter 1 is by itself, I can square root both. That's square root of 2 times the square root of d, the second diameter squared, and that in the end equals root 2 times d2. Now, root 2 is about equal to 1.4, which means that the diameter of the first circle, even though its area is twice as big as that of the second circle, the diameter of the first circle is approximately that of 1.4 times the diameter of the second circle. So now hopefully this is starting to make a little bit more sense. Let's actually figure out what the aperture, or rather the F number, might be. Let's say we have a very simple lens with a focal length of 1 millimeter. Let's see. So if I have an F number with a focal length of 1 millimeter, then I can say that, and if I assume that diameter 1 is 1.0, so let's see, diameter 1, I'll just say that I'm arbitrarily just giving it a random diameter of 1 inch or 1 centimeter or whatever, and that means that diameter 2, no, this is wrong. Diameter 1 would be 1.4 and diameter 2 would be 1, right? Because diameter 2 is 1. 1 times 1.4 is the result of diameter 1. So now, and I know I'm lost most of you, but we're almost there. I guarantee we're very, very close. Now, if I have a focal length of 1 divided by these diameters, so 1 over 1.4, and then the other one, F number, 1 over 1, so that means that I have F1 for this larger circle, if I assume just the focal length of 1, and 1 divided by 1.4, this actually works out pretty nicely. It also happens to be 1.4. Is that right? Something like that. Then we can see that that of the smaller diameter, A2, is this, 1.4. So they're related through this ratio. Now we could give these... if we assumed a different focal length and if we assumed a different diameter, this would still work out in the end because of this relationship of how the larger circle is related to the smaller one. In the end, it just matters that these two are related because one circle is twice as much as the other, but because when we're talking about area, we have to deal with this nasty squared, we have to get in, we can't easily double or halve these numbers. We have to do some funky stuff with square roots to actually get the end number. Now, this might look like it is going to be quite a pain to try to figure out what, or to try to remember what these F numbers are. But you don't have to. In fact, I don't have them memorized. The best way to do this is to remember the first two. Remember F1 and remember F1.4. You can probably do that. So if you remember F1 and 1.4, write those two down, then start doubling them. Double 1 and you get 2. Double 1.4 and you get 2.8. Then keep going. You have F2, so double that, you get F4. Double 2.8, you get 5.6. Double 4, you get 8. 5.6 times 2 is 11, so on and so forth. Well, it's about 11, but it's close enough. And that is how you're able to remember these two. So remember, or how you're able to remember all of the F numbers. So remember F1 and F1.4. Write those down and just start doubling, and you will be able to get this pretty easily. Now, we can actually, we could make this keep going and try to figure out what the smallest F number is, but this would get a little bit ridiculous. Yes?
So as you're doubling, you're throwing away small amounts of the numbers. When the camera is changing the lens aperture, is it also throwing away the small amounts of numbers, or is it going to like exactly 11.12?
So the question is, if when we're doubling this, we do some rounding. Does the camera do some rounding, or does it make it actually exact? That is a good question. I assume that it's going to make it exact so that the rest of the exposure values like shutter speed and ISO don't get affected too much. But it's going to be pretty minuscule until we get up to about, I don't know, even F11 is not that much of a difference from 5.6 times 2. So it's not going to make that much of a difference. And most of the time, you operate in this range, I would say. Almost 99% of the time, you operate in the F2.8 to F11 range. And there's just not very much variation in there. You have to have some pretty special lenses to get an aperture that's F2.0, 1.4, and F1.0 is almost unheard of. It's ridiculously expensive to create a lens with an aperture that's this big, and much smaller than this. So again, the bigger numbers give you a smaller aperture, so much smaller than about F16, you start to get a lot of weird issues that can crop up as a result of having such a small aperture. The light will actually cause a we'll talk more about this, of course, at a later date, all this stuff. Because light behaves as both a wave and a particle, when it hits a very, very small aperture, such as that from about F22 or farther, you can actually get the waves sort of canceling each other out in certain portions. So the end result is that you can actually get a fuzzy image for very, very small apertures, which is sort of counterintuitive, but it happens. And so most of the time, especially on cameras that have very, very small pixels, you can't really go beyond F11 or F16. In fact, this is one reason why many compact cameras can't go beyond F8. It's just because their pixels are too small. You will start to get some really weird issues that happen as a result that are difficult to explain, especially to just a casual user of a camera, why their photos are becoming very, very soft at these higher F numbers. Okay, so again, to solidify this, this lowest number, F1.0, means what in terms of stops in relation to, say, 1.4? So is 1.0 one stop brighter or one stop darker? Brighter, that's right. So this is pretty much as bright as you can go in a lens, and you keep going darker as you progress down this way. Now, just as is the case with shutter speed and ISO, many cameras will actually give you finer grained control than single stop increments. So sometimes, for example, between 1.4 and 2.0, you might see increments like 1.6, 1.8, and then 2.0. Those are third of a stop increments. Don't be confused. You still have these sort of to ground you in a basis of what is a stop. So you can go from 2.0 to 2.8 in one stop. Yes?
So even though this progression isn't linear, 1.6 and 1.8 represent one-third and two-thirds of a stop between 1.4 and 2.0?
Yeah, they take some liberties with thirds. I think, let's see, so from here, we can even cheat and look at the camera to see what it would say. So from 2.0 to 4.0, it goes 2.2 to 2.5 to 2.8, then 3.2 to 3.5 to 4.0. So it's enough of a differentiation so you can tell it's a third of a stop away, but they will be able to, they do the calculations internally to figure out exactly how big the aperture should be. It's not, so they do some rounding between these, even though it's not quite linear. Okay. Any other questions? All right. Now, with this is actually a pretty powerful equation, I would say. This F number equals the focal length divided by the diameter. So you might remember that the very first class we took that pinhole photo. And we took that pinhole photo with a certain shutter speed, but because that is essentially a homemade lens, I have no way of knowing what F number that pinhole was operating at. So we could actually try to calculate what this is. So again, and this same thing is also in the handout, and it's pretty interesting, I think, for you to give a quick read on how I calculated this. But if we take a look at the pinhole photo and we compare the shutter speed of that pinhole photo against something that we know. Let's say I put this lens on it and I use a known aperture like f2.0. And let's say that that gives me a certain shutter speed. Then I calculate the shutter speed with the pinhole. And I figure out that that pinhole photo is 12 stops away. So in other words, it was about 4,200 times darker using the pinhole photo. And the way that I was able to figure that out is because the shutter speed with that pinhole versus this lens at f2.0 with the same ISO, the ISO is unchanged, the shutter speed needed to be 4,200 times as long as the shutter speed with the lens to get the same exposure on the photo. So I can say that, okay, now this pinhole photo must have 4,200 times less light, which means, and if you do the division, that's about 12 stops less light than this one. So we can actually figure this out. So if we had 2.0 here, we can go to 2.8, that's one stop. To 4.0, that's two stops. To 5.6, three stops, so on and so on and so forth, until eventually we figure out that the F number of the pinhole photo, of the pinhole, rather, was F128. Which is ridiculously small. You are not going to see an F number that is that high unless you were doing something like this with a pinhole photo. Most lenses actually have a hard limit. Most 35 millimeter lenses have a hard limit of about F32. They just will not go beyond that because they cannot get any smaller of an aperture than that. But this aperture was F128. Now, let's say that I know the focal length of this lens. And the way that I would be able to know that is because of that symbol. Do you remember that symbol that I mentioned in the first class? This line with the circle? What does that symbol mean?
Sensor.
Right, it's the plane of the camera that contains the sensor. So at that point in the camera, there is the sensor. And you can measure the distance from that point to the point where the pinhole photo exists, or where that pinhole actually exists, and you would realize that the focal length then of the pinhole is 50 millimeters. So if I know the F number of the pinhole and I know the focal length of this homemade lens, I can then use this F number calculation to figure out approximately what the diameter of this pinhole is. Right, I can say that 128 equals 50 over the diameter and try to figure out what the diameter is. So this is 50 millimeters, so the diameter then is 50 millimeters over 128. And I actually get the diameter of the pinhole as 0.4 millimeters. So 4/10 of a millimeter is approximately the size of this pinhole. There were some approximations, it is about 12 stops, it's not exactly 12 stops, but this does give us a reasonably good calculation for the size of the pinhole itself. And that's pretty small. When I calculated this, that I was pretty proud of myself for being able to make a pinhole of that size, 0.4 millimeters. I think I could, if this doesn't work out, I could maybe be a seamster or something. So, moving on. Now, this is... Okay, good. Now, again, all of this information you can find and with a little bit more detail in this handout, and I highly recommend that you read it. But the most important thing for you to remember is that equation, that the F number is equal to the focal length divided by the diameter. Now, from that, we were able to figure out all of this other stuff. And I think that understanding this will give you a better intuition about what is going on with the light, what is happening with the camera, and will give you a little bit more insight into why these things are the way they are. So again, this is that same handout. You can find it on the course website, and it has the same little cheat sheet for you, how you can start at 1.0 and 1.4, double each respectively, and you will get the list of F numbers. It also has painstakingly crafted circles, one of which is exactly twice the area of the other, and a number of equations, all of which we have actually gone over in class just now. So are there any questions on this sort of mathy stuff? Hopefully now you understand why the F number is as crazy as it is. And it is important to, a lot of people use the term F number and aperture interchangeably, and that's, it's fine, but you'll notice that I try to use it a little bit more technically, and that is that the F number refers to that actual ratio of the focal length divided by the diameter, whereas the aperture actually refers to the physical aperture, the actual physical closing of the iris, so to speak, within the lenses. Now, let's see, skip over this. Okay, so what then does the aperture do for us? Besides letting in more light, or letting in less light, rather, is that it gives us background blur. Because of the way that the geometry of the optics works, which of course we will actually explore at a later date, we do get background blur as a result of having lower F numbers. So the lower the F number, the brighter the image, but also the more background blur you will get. So for example, this same image where we had stopped the motion, you will notice that the primary area of focus is on the players, and the ball and the background is slightly out of focus. And the reason for that, this is the blur that I am talking about. And there's other things that will give you the background blur as well. Big things are the size of the sensor, the focal length. There's just a whole variety of things that will give you more background blur. On the same camera, though, if we're talking about if you have one camera and you want more background blur, if you have the same lens, you want to use a lower F number for more background blur. Or if you can change lenses, typically you want to get a longer lens. So the more zoomed in the lens is and the lower the F number, the more amount of background blur that you will typically get. Now, if you want to make everything very, very sharp, though, you actually have to do something different. You have to increase the F number, which means that things will get darker, which means that you might have to do what? If things are darker because you have a smaller aperture, how can you compensate? So keep the shutter open for longer and or increase the sensitivity, increase the ISO. So you can do one or the other or both depending on what you're trying to achieve. Now sometimes you can actually make everything sharp. And this uses a special property of focusing called the hyperfocal distance. We'll talk, of course, more about the hyperfocal distance at a later point. But there's a special point and a special combination of focal length, F number, and focus distance where you can actually get pretty much everything from the focus point, so let's say it's focused about 6 feet away from you, you can get everything from half that distance, so 3 feet away, all the way to infinity in focus. And this is in contrast to using something like a low F number to try to give you a good isolation. So this is useful if you want to isolate the foreground from the background, very useful in portraits because you don't want the background disrupting or distracting the viewer from the actual portrait itself. It's useful to isolate whatever foreground object you want to. There's a whole host of reasons why you would use background blur, but sometimes you do want to get absolutely everything in focus, and this is when you would use this so-called hyperfocal distance. And generally, what this means is that you use the shortest focal length that you can, so you know, very, very wide shot if you can, the highest F number you can, and you have to, there's some additional math to actually calculate at what distance you can calculate the hyperfocal distance, but of course, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Now,
sorry, what was the first thing you
The first thing I said, I don't even remember. Oh, yes. So you want to, generally, if you want less background blur, if you want to get more in focus, you want to use a lower focal length, which means that you want to have, you know, capture as much of the scene as you want or as you can. So the widest lens that you have at its widest setting with the highest F number you can reasonably go. And remember that this could be problematic, especially if you're in a dark area without a tripod. If you're using a very high F number, you are going to have problems with getting shutter speed at a reasonable hand-holdable amount. You'll have problems setting the ISO at a reasonable low noise amount. So this is all, as in the rest of photography, very give and take. But this will be the best way of giving you the most of the frame into focus that you possibly can. Yes? Where do you focus? So we will talk more about the hyperfocal distance in the optics lecture, because I will have to introduce yet another scary equation for us to figure this out. But there are ways that you can calculate the hyperfocal distance. I think there's a website called dofmaster.com. Let's see, hopefully, yep, this is it. So dofmaster, they actually have some tools that you can input a variety of things like the camera you're using, the focal length, and the F number, excuse me, to be able to calculate where you should focus. Typically, if you want to give, so calculating the hyperfocal distance, you should use something like this or the equation that we will show you at a later time. But generally, you want to focus not at infinity and not very close to you, so somewhere in the middle, usually like 6 to 12 feet with all of these variables that I told you, the lowest focal length and the highest F number. That will generally give you the most amount of depth of field that you possibly can get. And depth of field, to reiterate, is just the depth of area that is in focus. So this has very narrow depth of field because only the players are in focus, whereas the ball is slightly out of focus and the background is out of focus, whereas this photo has very, very wide, has very large depth of field because much of it is in focus. So the depth of field refers to how much of in front of the camera, in front of and behind the focus point in the camera will actually be in focus. But of course, optics lecture, so on and so forth, later dates, all of that fun stuff. So smaller aperture means that you get a bigger depth of field and less light and a higher F number. A smaller F number means a larger aperture. It means more depth, or it means less depth of field, so you get more of a background blur and you get more light into the camera. Now, typically, you can see the maximum range that your lens is capable of producing if you just look at the spec. So on this lens, for example, we can see that it is a 2.8 lens, so that means that it's at its widest open setting, this lens can only do 2.8, f2.8, but it can go, so it that range, if you remember, it can't do 2.0, it can't do 1.4, it starts at 2.8 and it can get darker from there. Whereas other lenses, usually primes will generally do a little bit better of a job. Primes will typically have wider apertures to begin with. So this lens, for example, has an aperture of 1.8, which is considerably brighter than the 2.8 of even this much larger lens. Now, we've talked then about these three things: shutter speed, ISO, and aperture. And these are the three settings on your camera that affect the exposure of the photo. And each of them, depending on the particular setting that you're using, might change drastically the appearance of the photograph, even for a well-exposed photograph. If you have too slow of a shutter speed, you might get some motion blur. If you have too high of an ISO, you might get some noise. If you have too small of an aperture, too high of an F number, then you might get too much in focus. All of these things are definitely important, and it's very, very much plays into the give and take, but there's one extremely important thing that affects the exposure that just about everybody overlooks, and that is the amount of available light. This is ultimately what is going to define how your camera is able, or what settings your camera can use and what you can use to try to take a photo. Because if you have less light, you're going to have fewer options in terms of handholdability, in terms of having a very high F number, in terms of having a very fast shutter speed, compared to when you have a lot of light available to you. Now, you could actually have the opposite problem. You could have too much light, And so you're very much restricted to having high F numbers and very fast shutter speeds. But that's another problem entirely. It's depending on the scene, it's almost easier to take away light than it is to add it, especially when you realize that you can put filters in front to decrease the amount of light in the scene, and that you can't really place a filter to increase the amount of light. You can use flash, but flash is a different beast entirely that we will, of course, talk about at a later date, etc. It's actually next week, so it's not too bad. Now, with these three settings, no longer do you have to use these basic modes that your camera comes with. The little green circle that decides what all of these settings are for you, you no longer have to use it. And in fact, there is a little bit of a cheat that we can do. If you have a bright sunny day, you can use the sunny 16 rule. The sunny 16 rule says that on a very bright sunny day, you will have a shutter speed of 1/100th of a second and an ISO of 100 with an F number of F16. And you can start from this and you can alter as appropriate. So let's say that I wanted to have a faster shutter speed. What can I do? If this properly exposes a photo on a bright sunny day and I want a faster shutter speed than 1/100th of a second, what can I do? I can increase the sensitivity. So I can go to ISO 200, and then my shutter speed would be 1/200th of a second. So let's go back. So at the sunny 16 rule, 1/100th of a second, ISO 100, aperture F16. I can alter also the F number. So I can go from F16 down to what? F11, right. F11 is one stop away. So that means that I could have a shutter speed of 1/200th of a second at ISO 100 and an aperture of F11. And I can keep going. I can go down to F8. Then I would have 1/400th of a second, and so on and so forth. Then I can also increase the ISO. So I can go to 200, and then I would get 1/800th of a second. So all of these are related in this way. If you want to keep the same exposure, if you increase the stop for one of these variables, you have to decrease it for another. Now, there's some modifications to the sunny 16 rule depending on the type of day that you have. So if it's slightly overcast, for example, you would go down one stop, which means that you would go down to about F11. If it's overcast, then you're down two stops to F8. If it's heavily overcast, you go down three stops to F5.6, and you would adjust all of these settings accordingly depending on what you want. If you want higher ISO, higher shutter speed, more or less F number, really depends ultimately on what you are trying to do. So you can use the manual mode now. Use it. I'm serious. Try it. See how it works for you. You will be surprised. It might take a little bit of getting used to, but you will be surprised at how well you'll be able to expose a variety of scenes just very, very quickly. And in fact, it's a good way to learn how your camera is behaving, how your photos will actually look, just by altering each of these three settings. So and hopefully we'll have not many more rainy days, and you will have some bright sunny days that you can go outside and try the sunny 16 rule. I have to be honest, this doesn't apply very often to us here in Cambridge. It applies much more, especially if you're in the Southwest, where bright sunny day, they really mean bright and sunny days. Here you probably will notice that you actually have to, even if it's kind of bright and kind of sunny, you might actually have to increase it by about a stop, so bring it down to about an aperture of F11. But the sunny 16 rule is a good place to start, and that is what this is. 1/100th of a second, ISO of 100, and F16 for your F number. Now, oh, yes?
So if you brought it down to F11, then you have to change
one of
the others,
or
would you
ever think
like that?
Not necessarily. So this applies only to the bright sunny day. If it is not bright and sunny, so maybe it's only sunny, maybe it's only bright, then you might actually have to alter this. So like I said before, if it's slightly overcast, then that means that you're going to have less light available to you, and you have to modify this rule, and you would start at 1/100th of a second and ISO 100 and an aperture of about F11. Just by virtue of having less light in the environment. Whereas heavily overcast would be, let's see, what did I say, down three stops versus slightly overcast, which is down one stop, which means that your aperture would actually be F5.6. because that's three stops down. You would start with that setting, and you would alter each of these as appropriate, depending on your lens's capability and the shutter speed that you want, the sensitivity that you want, the ISO that you want, etc. Now, to give you an idea, let's say that we have so rather than having a bright and sunny day, we are outside and there's not a cloud in the sky, it's at night, and we have a full moon. Now, just to give you an idea of the difference, this is actually 18 or 19 stops slower than this. So we would have to use something like, we would have to, if we alter the shutter speed, that means that we would have a shutter speed of 50 minutes at an ISO of 100 and an aperture of f/16. That is 18 to 19 stops slower. Remember that a stop doesn't mean times. You can't do 1/100th of a second times 18 or 19. You have to multiply it by 2 or divide it by 2 that many times. So 1/100th of a second times 2 is 1/50th, times 2 is 1/25th, so on and so on and so forth. 18 or 19 times, you realize that it is actually 50 minutes. And this actually brings us to a very good point. Now, the moon landings, I mean, this was, a big thing, and there are always the conspiracy theorists in the world that will give a myriad of reasons of why the moon landings were faked. And I can't comment one way or another if they were, but I can address one particular thing that they love to bring up, and that is the fact that in each of the moon landing photos, there are no visible stars. Look at this photo. There's no stars. If we were in space, they argue, you would expect to see stars. But that is simply not the case. And this links back to what we were just talking about with the sunny 16 rule. When it is a bright sunny day, it is bright. It is very, very bright, very, very sunny. For us to see stars, well, we can't on a bright sunny day. And that is because the sun is so overpowering. We would have these settings, 1/100th of a second, ISO 100, and an f/16 on your camera in order to properly obtain an exposure on a bright and sunny day. Now, I just mentioned that if it were a full moon outside, and maybe in a full moon you can see some stars, especially if we're not in the heavily light polluted area that we are around here, you'd be able to see some stars, but I also said that is 18 to 19 stops darker. And your camera might have some range. It might be able to capture several stops darker and several stops brighter than this, but it does not have 18 to 19 stops of difference. And that is what we are seeing here. This is the equivalent of a bright and sunny day on the moon. The sun is shining. The sun is very, very bright. So to properly expose this photograph, they might have used something like the equivalent of the sunny 16 rule on this particular camera, which means, 1/100th of a second at ISO 100 at f/16, and at those settings, the stars in the background are not bright enough to be captured by film. It cannot be done because there's not enough range in the film to be able to capture that dim of a light source. It just does not happen. So just because there is a lack of atmosphere doesn't mean that we can throw out all of this exposure knowledge that we have. And in fact, the lack of an atmosphere makes the sun even more harsh. You'll notice that the shadows are extremely harsh here, and that is because the sun is the only source of light. It is not reflecting around in the sky or off of clouds or what have you. It is, though, it is reflecting a little bit off of the dust, the sand that exists on the moon itself. But that's why he is illuminated and not completely in the shadow, by the way, because there is light that is reflecting off of the contours of the sand and reflecting back onto him. But he is visibly darker than the highly, heavily sunny regions directly behind him. So just with these exposure ideas, can we eliminate at least this one idea from conspiracy theorists? Now, we can even take a look at some of the more modern photos that exist. And so there was a couple of years ago a Japanese satellite from the JAXA agency, that's the Japanese equivalent of NASA, where they did a fly around the moon, and they were able to capture in HD an Earthrise over the moon. And this was actually very fantastic. And what they were able to do is, as it moved around the moon, they were able to point their cameras to where the Earth's position was going to be, and the Earth would slowly rise over the moon's horizon. It's stunning, and I'll put a link to it on the course website. It's stunning to view, even if it takes a little while. It's just sort of amazing to see the world from a different perspective. But even here, can you see the same sort of problems that I was just referring to? And that is that the exposure, that the light from the sun is so bright compared to that of the stars in the background that the stars just do not have a prayer of being bright enough to appear in the photograph. Because we are exposing for the quantity of light that is given by the sun. And in fact, here we can now see that the shadows are even harsher. The shadows are extremely harsh just because there is nothing really to reflect the light. There's not enough light that's being shown down into it for it to reflect back and really illuminate the craters. This is a really neat thing. Okay, moving on, when we're talking, so to bring back this original idea that I had mentioned before of overexposure, you do have to keep in mind this similar idea of range. It is possible to have too much variety of light, too much variety in the intensity of the light for you to properly expose everything in the photograph. So here, for example, this is the photo of an entrance of a cave, and inside the cave it's going to be very, very dark. Outside the cave it's going to be very, very bright on a bright sunny day. So you have to make a decision, what are you going to expose for properly? And here it's just sort of the interface right at the entrance of the cave, but you can see inside the cave it's pitch black. There's not enough photons reaching the sensor for it to be able to capture any detail. And here on these rocks you can see that it is heavily overexposed. We've lost detail on the rocks just due to this overexposure. So unfortunately there's no way we can directly correct this problem, at least not altering those three settings that I had mentioned before. And this is where that fourth idea, altering the quantity of light, will actually come into play. So we would have to do something special if we wanted to try to get everything in this scene exposed properly. So we might have to alter the amount of light. So maybe we would hold like a big white sheet of paper over, a big white sheet of paper over this area to try to reduce the amount of harsh sun that's beating down here. We might use a reflector, which is, again, the equivalent of a big white sheet of paper that you hold up against the sun, and then it reflects light sort of into the entrance of the cave so that there's more light in this area. And all of these ideas, the only thing they do is just alter the amount of light that is actually within this scene. So we're either decreasing the amount of light or we're increasing it, but the ultimate goal is to try to level out the range of brightness. It's trying to make it a little bit less harsh so that the shadows aren't quite so dark and that the rocks outside are not quite as bright. There's another thing you could do also that's fill flash. You might have a flash that you could fire in the entrance of the cave and try to make that area a little bit brighter just by adding some additional light there as well. Now sometimes though, there's nothing you can really do just because you're taking a picture of a landscape and it's just too big of a scene for you to put a big white something over. It's just not going to happen effectively. And you can get, especially when we're talking about sunset photos or photos that are taken in the day, the sun is very, very harsh and it will give you very, very wide range of brightness in the scene. So in this case, this is heavily underexposed just because it is exposed properly for the sky. You can see the details in the sky. You can see the clouds that exist within the sky, but you lose all of the details underneath the mountain. And there might have been some interesting details, like what is this little thing right here? We no longer are able to see it just because of that. And unfortunately, the only way to correct this is luck or timing or both. So you have to pick a good time of day. An appropriate time of day might be like dusk or dawn, because the light is softest then and it's reflecting the most off of a variety of things. You will have the best chance of getting a well-exposed shot at dusk or dawn. In fact, in general, I would say if you're going to take photos outside, wait for dusk or get up for dawn. That will be the best time for you to take a photo. Once it's midday, put away the camera. It's going to be awful. It's going to be horrible. Just reserve your camera for dusk and dawn. You will have the best photos. Other times is when it's cloudy and overcast, because the clouds will actually diffuse a lot of the light, and that will be a good way of helping you get some additional light down here, or at least darkening the sky a little bit. And that's pretty much it. That's really all you can do, is be lucky with the weather or wait for the appropriate time of day. And even then, you still have to be lucky with the weather. You can't have, it can't be rainy or you'll be miserable when you're sitting outside. So let's see, some of this is out of our control. Now quickly, there are really bad situations you can get yourself into, like in this photo, which I'm always embarrassed to show. But this, I thought, oh man, this will be cool. I'll show the sky and the bridge at the same time. I should have known that the sky was going to be far too bright and the shadows in the bridge were going to be far too dark. So there's almost nothing that is properly exposed in this photo. The bridge is far too dark, except where it's illuminated by light, where it's far too bright, and the sky has just been completely destroyed by all of the light that exists. Yes? Yeah, this is okay, and I guess so is the water, but that's not really all that interesting, I'm afraid. So in this case, I gotta say, take another photo. I abandoned this idea. As soon as I looked at it, I was like, oh, forget it. I know I'm not gonna be able to do this. Unless you manage to have a whole row of flashes that you can put along the side here, but that's expensive and difficult to do. Now, sometimes though, you do want to under or overexpose. Sometimes you want to be able to fully isolate an object, like in many commercial type applications where you're in a studio and you want to try to get a completely dark background, for example. You want to completely underexpose the background. Well, all you have to do is put enough light on the foreground object that the background just sort of goes away into obscurity by how dark it is. And in this case, this, you don't need an expensive studio setup. This is frankly just done with a couple of desk lamps and a black t-shirt that was hanging on a chair behind it. And all you have to do is make sure you have the desk lamps situated properly, that you can illuminate only the object and not the background at all, and then take a long enough shutter speed. This was 8 seconds, and you will be able to get something like this appropriately. Then conversely, you can throw out the black t-shirt and put a whole bunch of white paper. I don't recommend a white t-shirt because the texture will actually appear in the background here. Oh, another trick for this underexposure, use a very low F number. Don't use a very high F number, because if you do, what will happen is that you will get the background in focus and you might see some of the texture. So use sort of a low enough F number where you can get just enough of the object in focus and no more. Whereas for this one, you want to illuminate more of the background than you do the object itself. So you would then reposition all of your lamps to illuminate the background almost entirely. This could have used maybe just a little bit more light in the foreground to really bring out the label here, but it's frankly, I had two desk lamps and white sheets of paper, so this is what I was able to do with it. And so, with that, we have managed to catch up with the material for this week, and next time, we will continue talking about exposure. Thank you all for coming. We will see you then. Oh, don't forget, assignment 1 is due next week.